This week on the River Avenue Blues Podcast, we're talking about the series out in Seattle, looking ahead to the Oakland series with Jason Wojciechowski of Baseball Prospectus, and talking about the draft with Mike. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the River Avenue Blues Podcast. I'm Joe, Jay is with me today, and we're talking a little bit about the Seattle series that's currently going on. We're recording this before the game starts on Thursday night. Jay, it turns out that that rainout was just a really huge blessing. It moved a Vidal Nuno start from Yankee Stadium on the road to one of the more favorable pitcher's parks in the league, and the Yankees really reaped the benefits.
Yeah, it's nice to see Nuno, kind or Nuno, however you want to pronounce it. He keeps going out there, and he's getting it done somehow. I don't know if he's using, you know, black magic or something. But, I mean, he goes out there. He puts up his requisite five or six innings and gives you at least something. It's not always great, and it's even better when it's not at Yankee Stadium. And that's what we got to kind of start off the series. Then we move on to last night, Wednesday, with Masahiro Tanaka basically doing the same thing he keeps doing over and over again, which is winning. It's pretty unbelievable. Right now, it's hard to say that he's anything less than the best pitcher in the American League. You know, we had a conversation briefly this morning where we talked about it. And, you know, the numbers would lead you to believe that Felix Hernandez and Yu Darvish are more valuable pitchers. But if you think about it in the true value sense of what they mean to an organization, I can't think of someone that means more to any organization in the American League as far as a starting pitcher is concerned than Masahiro Tanaka.
Yeah, no, that's true. And what we were talking about with value, it's Fangraph's WAR, which is based on fielding independent pitching. Mm-hmm. Which to me, I'm sorry, I don't. That's the one reason I really do not like Fangraph's layout for pitcher WAR, because there's no, like, why are we giving a value metric based on a theoretical stat?
Sure.
If you look at straight ERA, you look at straight run average, you look at you put the peripherals together and you adjust and you say, all right, Felix pitches his home games in Seattle and Tanaka pitches his home games at Yankee Stadium, and it's a completely different story. And as I said, I side with you guys. Tanaka, to me, has been the most valuable pitcher in the American League to date.
It's very difficult to kind of look at it any other way. I mean, I understand that Seattle has a guy like Felix Hernandez who's really – he's the anchor of that whole franchise. Whether you want to say it's Robinson Cano.
No, it's
Robinson
Felix.
Cano, it's Felix, period. He's been that guy for so long, and – now you can probably say that Yu Darvish has become that for Texas, because while Texas has some great players on that team, I mean, it's very difficult to think of someone that they could, you know, lose and not have that pain felt than a guy like Yu Darvish. And the season started out that way.
Yeah.
I mean, you could probably say, well, them losing Prince Fielder was a giant hit and everyone else that the Rangers have lost. But I'm going to say that if they lost Yu Darvish, they might as well just pack it up for the season. And I feel the exact same way about the Yankees and Masahiro Tanaka. If for some reason he wasn't able to make, you know, 5 to 7 starts somewhere throughout the rest of the season, I would just say, I don't know how you're going to get through it.
Yeah, they're already down 3 starters. I mean, they're like pasting together games using Whitley and Phelps. Well, Phelps goes a little bit deeper into games. Mm-hmm. You know, Whitley and Nuno are going, you know, they're going 5 innings a game, 5 and change, and they're piecing together. Now, Girardi's doing a great job with this too, using DeSantis and Warren.
I absolutely agree.
And guys, like, he's using them for multiple innings, which I think is why Preston Claiborne got sent down.
Because, well, I think there was also because Kelly gives him a little different look.
Well, he's like the more traditional one inning. Like, they have the 8th inning guy and the 9th inning guy, but all before that, they have 3 guys in Warren Betances and now Jose Ramirez.
Yeah, and I feel like
they can give you 2 innings at a clip.
And I feel like the Ramirez is one of those guys that, you know, they feel like if it comes off to me like he's been on the periphery of being that guy that's the next in line to kind of come in and take a back, or I should say more of like, I guess, the front end of your bullpen spot. You know, it's probably comparable to what Claiborne did last year. You know, Claiborne wasn't really a short and close kind of guy. He was more like your sixth, seventh, get an out or two kind of dude. And I feel like that's what Ramirez is going to be for right now. But it's a really interesting place the Yankees are in right now, especially you mentioned Chase Whitley. Right now, he's hanging with a 2.42 ERA in five games started. I mean, that's a major league pitcher. He's pretty much proven, you know, he's not really someone that you're going to look at as, well, he's a future of your rotation. I mean, he's a nice five, an easy five, that or a four. I mean, I don't know what he projects to be beyond this, but I also look at him as a guy that he lines up very easy to be another Phelps, you know, a guy that's useful in a few different roles, and you know he'll probably stick in this role until someone better than him is available to come back in the rotation, I'd imagine.
He's not the first guy out of the rotation either. First guy who comes back takes Nuno out of the rotation, I'm certain.
Yeah.
And then Whitley, because Whitley, he doesn't strike a lot of guys out, but he's got a good ground ball rate. He keeps the ball down. He hasn't allowed a homer yet this year. He hasn't walked many guys. Like he's the number eight starter.
And, three walks in 26 innings.
Yeah, he's the number eight starter on this team, and he is. I mean, I don't think we've seen the Yankees have a better number eight starter since 2005, when they had Aaron Small and guys like and Sean Chacon bailing them out in the second half and getting to the playoffs.
And what's crazy about that is that Chase Whitley's a guy that's like, you know, he actually came up through their system. He's not somebody that just, you know, they pulled off the scrap heap and prayed for a few good starts like they did with Small and Chacon. You know, those were guys who had been around the block for a while. You know, we're talking about a guy, you know, he went to Troy College. I mean, he's not a guy that, you know, you looked at before the season and said he was a guy at all. You know, he's a 2010 15th round pick. Yeah,
475 overall. So, I mean, that's just not a spot where guys usually do much. But, you know, if the Cardinals can pull some value out of those picks, why not the Yankees?
Yeah, and it's nice to see. So let's see. What do we got tonight for the Yankees?
It's Whitley, right? It's Whitley, right?
Yeah.
The guy from the Mariners shut down the Yankees last time. Ronis Elias or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I can't pronounce his name, and I'm not gonna try to butcher it because, you know, sensitive about name things.
Sure. Then tomorrow, or I should say the weekend, we've got
Sonny Gray tomorrow.
Yeah, that's
Sonny
a
Gray
rough
and
one.
David Phelps. That's not going to be a very good, very favorable matchup. And at, well, least they're out, at least they're in Oakland, so Phelps isn't. It's harder for Phelps to give up a bomb. But Sonny Gray is one of the league's premier pitchers at this point too.
Yeah, he's a 6-2 with a 2.83 ERA kind of guy. I kind of wish he would have matched up against Tanaka. I think that probably would have been a premier kind of matchup.
Yeah.
Then we have over the weekend as well, we've got Kuroda versus Kazmir. And finally, we've got Nuno versus Jesse Chavez, a guy, if I remember, he's having a decent year for a guy who is kind of like, he's been a middling kind of guy who's somehow or another finally found it.
Yeah. The Yankees, they hit him well enough. I think they had like one really good inning against him last time out.
Yeah, they did.
And didn't hit much off him otherwise. That was the same with Kazmir too, right? He started off really slowly and then kind of settled in. Yeah. Or am I misremembering that?
I don't remember, but
well, the Yankees didn't score many runs in that series, period. So,
well, the Yankees picked up their four runs against Jesse Chavez, but that was in the third inning. The rest of the game, they were pretty much shut down. Let me take a look at Kazmir.
Kazmir, I think he gave up a couple runs early, but the A's won that game.
But the Yankees have been lucky enough that they've missed Sonny Gray the last time around. But unfortunately, they're going to beat him. But just to get into Kazmir, you know, right now he's working with a 2.20 ERA with an 82 innings. I mean, if there's a guy who looks like he's back, it's Scott Kazmir. He's been throwing the ball with such conviction and authority. It's really impressive.
Yeah, and he's another reason why you don't doubt Billy Beane, because Beane took a lot of crap for signing Kazmir this offseason. Signed him early.
It was a 2-year deal, if I'm right.
2 years, $22 million, so he signed him early. He had a good year for Cleveland last year. He started off rough, but he kind of built his way up and had a good, he ended the year strong. But Beane goes out and signs him pretty early in the offseason for Oakland, big contract. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of derision among baseball commentary that, Beane overpaid, this is a big risk. And of course, Jerry Parker goes down, AJ Griffin goes down, and the Kazmir signing looks doubly good because he's thriving.
Yeah, and just to back up what you were talking about before, last time he went out there and he shut the Yankees down. He held them to one run. It looks like, yeah,
it was one run.
Was it one or two? They scored two runs. I'm not sure he had all the earned runs, but they ended up losing that game 5-2.
Yeah, that was that was a late one of those. That was like the signature in that series was, hey, the game's close, and then in the eighth inning, the game's not close anymore.
Yeah. So just to kind of recap what's been going on, obviously, and we'll talk a little about this with Mike. The draft just went by, came and went pretty quickly, it feels like, and the Yankees have started the process of getting internal promotions done. Staten Island season started up, so you're starting to see guys get moved around, and we talk a little bit more about this. So coming up next, we'll talk a little bit with Mike, and eventually we've got an interview today that Joe's going to do give you a little bit more insight into, because I'm not going to even dare say the name.
Jason Wojciechowski.
There you go. So that's pretty much it. We'll be right back with the River Avenue Blues podcast.
This is the New York Yankees Injury Update, sponsored by Nobody. If you'd like to sponsor this segment, please contact us, podcast@riveravenueblues.com. Well, the Yankees got at least one player back from the disabled list. Reliever Sean Kelly has been activated from the 15-day disabled list after a couple setbacks to his back injury. He is back in line to get eighth inning appearances, so all is back to normal in the bullpen pretty much. Francisco Cervelli, he went on the disabled list on April 14th, and that means his 60 days is up when you are listening to this, when is June 13th. So it seems like he will be activated. We don't know for sure. It's hard to keep a guy on the DL if he is out of options and ready to be, ready for activation. So we'll see if the Yankees do anything with him. I suspect this weekend at the very latest, but Friday is a logical enough date since is his date to come off the 60-day disabled list. John Ryan Murphy could be the guy to go down since they only need two catchers on the roster, but they have him playing Cervelli at first base. He has a little bit of experience playing around the infield, so there's a small possibility, very small possibility, that they leave Alfonso Soriano in the dust. I don't think that's particularly an option right now because they're short on outfielders with Carlos Beltran limited to DH duty. So chances are they're just going to take the path of least resistance option Murphy until they have a better option. And I think the better option is going to come when the trade deadline rolls around. I've been certain about it since the beginning of the season that the Yankees would deal at least one of their catchers at the trade deadline. Michael Pineda, there's no real update on. He had the setback, was the last update. He's supposed to, he's kind of back on a throwing program. I don't know if he's back on a throwing program. He got hurt on June 1st. He's supposed to be picking up a ball sometime soon. Again, it's going to take him a while to get back. The Yankees' actual updates is possibly early July. Given that we haven't gotten a real update on him, I'm thinking, just like CeCe Sabathia, after the All-Star break. And, CeCe Sabathia, since the last time we had an update, he's been tossing, but he's not made any real progress towards a return. So we shouldn't expect anything from him as well until after the All-Star break. So that's been the New York Yankees Injury Update, sponsored by Nobody.
Welcome back to the River Avenue Blues Podcast. My name is Jay, and along with me, we've got Joe and, of course, Mike. So we've just got past the draft recently. Got a lot of things that have actually been going on. But first and foremost, we could talk a little bit about the draft. The Yankees didn't have a first-round draft pick, and that has a lot to do with the fact that they went pretty wild in free agency, as we all know. But they did have a pick at number 55, and you want to talk a little bit, just for a second, Mike, about the pick the Yankees made?
Yeah, they their first pick was in the second round because they signed all those free agents, and they used it on a reliever. They used it on a lefty reliever from Mississippi State named Jacob Lindgren. And, you know, whenever you hear that it's a lefty reliever, it's like automatically – like pops into your head that he's a lefty specialist, but that's not the case. Lindgren is expected to be like a very good impact reliever who just happens to throw left-handed. And, you know, I think if you read pretty much everything written about the draft, the consensus is that he could probably pitch in the major leagues this year. And at the very latest, you know, he should be up next year. And, you know, Matt Thornton hasn't been bad, but like every time he pitches, you don't really feel comfortable with him out there. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, Lindgren could get an opportunity later in the season, you know, when rosters expand in September. You know,
yeah, I've heard a lot of people say that he looks like the kind of guy that could be more helpful in the immediate future rather than, you know, that kind of 3 to 5 year thing that you kind of feel you always get out of draft picks, at least with the Yankees. The Yankees, it feels like. If they pick someone out of the draft, you're not going to see them for a very long time. But I think that this may be a guy that might be different.
And I do think that was intentional somewhat that, you know, we've been hearing about this, like, big upcoming international spending spree that they're planning.
Yeah.
That is like, where they're going to add all these, like, high-risk and, like, high-reward guys who are 5 years away from the big leagues. And not just Lindgren, but really, for the most part, this entire draft, they used their picks for guys who are safer, quote-unquote safer, that are going to get to the majors quicker, and they tried to balance it out that way. Now, Lindgren's a bit of like an extreme example because everybody thinks he could pitch this year, but the rest of the draft, you're looking at guys who are maybe only 2 years away instead of five.
Mm-hmm. So do you think – and let me ask you a quick question, and this is more or less for both of you guys. Do you think with the idea of like the Yankees kind of shifting focus on their I guess how they're acquiring talent to be more focused on international, that they're basically saying every year we're basically crapping out at the draft? I mean, is it indicative of that, or is it just that they're not getting the picks that they really need?
You know, I think this year was a special kind of circumstance because, you know, they missed the playoffs last year, and that's not good for business. You know, that hurts the
bottom. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, they knew that they were going to spend a lot of money in free agency to add players, and they were going to lose picks. They were, you know, and when you talk about guys like Ellsbury and McCann, it's like, who cares about the draft pick? And, you know, when you start giving up picks for like, complimentary players and, you know, spare parts, that's when it's a problem. But for, you know, guys like Ellsbury, nobody cares. And so they knew they weren't going to have the picks. And, you know, there's always seemed to be rumblings of, like, of an international draft. So this might be their last chance to kind of just sign whoever they want. And they figure, you know, we'll spend the whatever, you know, the number is like $30 million or something like that. We'll just spend it, sign whoever, deal with the penalties, because there's a good chance we might never be able to spend freely again. And I don't think, you know, I don't think it's a change in philosophy, because if there is no international draft, they're going to have to deal with the penalties of spending so much money. And, you know, there's like limits on how much they could sign players for and stuff like that. I think this year was just a special case because they gave up all those picks because they wanted to try to get back to contention. And, you know, it just kind of fell into place that, all right, let's just spend all this money on the international free agents because we can spend that freely. And we'll just deal with whatever we deal with in the draft.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And here's a question about that: is the penalty for they can't sign any player for over what $250,000 next year because they have the most severe penalty?
It's $300,000 for the next 2 years.
That's what I was going to ask you. It is a 2 year penalty, so it's not like you can have an every other year strategy of doing this. So I mean, the Yankees must really believe that there's an international draft coming within the next 2 years. And if not, they can do this again in another 2 years. But, you know, being limited in that, you know, the way I look at it is, are they better off balancing their international spending and staying under the budget, or just going hog wild this year and, you know, stocking up on guys? And you know, I think they'll get more actual prospects doing it this way than they would by spreading out and staying within the limits.
Yeah, you know, I've kind of gone back and forth on this. And there's two things here to consider. That the Yankees do actually do a really good job of getting, like, under the radar international guys who don't sign for much money. I think Luis Severino was one of their better pitching prospects. He signed for like $200,000, and they've had, and even Ivan Nova only signed for like $80,000. And they're good at digging up these kind of diamonds in the rough, and that makes it a little bit easier to kind of swallow the penalties for the next 2 years. But like you said, you're basically eliminating 2/3 of the talent pool. You know, you're going to get, all right, fine, you're going to spend on all these very good prospects this year, but you're not getting the best prospects next year or the year after. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, you don't want that to happen. You want to be able to sign anyone. You know, the question is, do you want to sign the best players this year and just okay players, or do you want to just balance it out and take some pretty good players every year? And, you know, it's obviously the Yankees are going to evaluate it however they see these guys. And if they think this year's prospects are really good, we should spend wild here and not do, you know, we don't have to worry about it so much next year. Maybe that's how they see it. But we are talking about like 14-year-old kids.
Yeah.
How you project what the, you know, what the international class of players looks like in 2016. That's like impossible.
No, it is. But if you think about it this way, there was a report today, well, yesterday, because you're listening to this on Friday, that the Yankees have already come to terms or verbal agreements with three players for a total of $9 million. You could spread those three players out over the next 3 years, hypothetically, and the Yankees would go over every single year. So, basically, like, they wouldn't be able to get any of these three players without hitting a penalty those years. So it seems like this is kind of like the strategy to do, and I think the Yankees doing this, you know, the Rangers have done it, the Cubs have done it, but I think the Yankees are doing it is going to be the catalyst for change.
Well, yeah, because they're the Yankees, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think, and you know, there's always the sense of, you know what, once we go over, let's just go way over. You know, there's no point in going, because the penalties are triggered at like 5% overage or something like that. It's like, there's no point in going 6% over. You might as well just blow right by and do whatever. It's like the draft pick thing. It's like, fine, we give up a draft pick for McCann. Let's just give up a second rounder for Ellsbury, give up a third rounder for Beltran. Who cares? Those picks aren't as valuable. And you know, it's, and you know what, part of it is, the Yankees, they've gotten criticized a lot for their farm system not being productive. Late last year, there was all this talk about, they kind of just reviewed their whole player development system, and you know, there was talk of people getting fired and things changing, and there was no personnel changes, but there were some like structural and just procedural changes and stuff like that. And I think this is also part of that. You know, they hear the criticism, and you know, I think they know that, listen, our farm system was not good last year, because whenever somebody got hurt, whoever came up didn't really produce. The only guy who did was Adam Warren. And I think they just said, you know, let's just go crazy, get some talent here and start developing these kids, because it hasn't worked the last few years.
And what a spectacular segue you've given us, Mike. I'm sorry, Joe, but I really had to kind of take that moment and use it as a segue. And that leads to Rob Reisnyder to kind of discuss, a guy who, let's face it, you know, your average kind of, you know, everyday, not really all that deep into it Yankee fan might not really know who Rob Reisnyder was prior to this season, but his name keeps coming up this year because... One, the Yankees have started playing him at second base in the minors, and two, he's been hitting just a ton of homers.
Yeah, and not just that he's hit a few homers, it's really he's just like hitting, he's just getting like two hits a night, it seems. Mm-hmm. I remember like, geez, I guess this was like 8 years ago now, but back then, you know, I used to subscribe to like Baseball America's daily email, and I remember... Back then, every day I used to check the email, and Howie Kendrick, every day he was like 2 for 4. And that's pretty much what it is with Reisnyder right now. He's just, every day it's like 2 hits, 3 hits, 2. He just keeps hitting.
Do you have a little, just a for the people who might not know much more than, you know, what we've said about Rob, can you give us a brief rundown of how the Yankees kind of got a hold of this guy and where he came from?
Yeah, he's actually got like a pretty interesting backstory. He was born in South Korea, and he was adopted by a family in California when he was like 3 months old or some kind of ridiculously young age. And, you know, he played like 100, you know, played like every sport possible in high school. And he was a second baseman in high school. He went to the University of Arizona, and he was an outfielder there because I guess they had some good second baseman that they weren't going to move, you know, some, you know, senior or junior, whoever had been there. So they stuck him in the outfield. He played there. The Yankees put him back at second base because that's kind of, you know, second baseman is more valuable than a left fielder or whatever, and they wanted to try it. So, you know, and while he was in college, he was a very good college player. He won the Arizona won the College World Series 1 year. He was named MVP of the tournament.
Most outstanding player, I believe.
Most
outstanding. I like how they call it outstanding.
Yeah, most outstanding player. So he's like one of those guys who is like one everywhere. And you know, that really kind of gets thrown. You know, people like to talk about the guy who's won everywhere he's gone, but it doesn't really kind of mean much. You know, Darwin Barney like won like two College World Series, but he kind of sucks. And so it doesn't really matter. But so the Yankees draft, anyway, the Yankees drafted him. I think it was the fifth round, fourth or fifth. I think it was the fifth. They stuck him back at second base, and he's just hit like nonstop. And they started him last year in low A Charleston, promoted him after 60 games. So basically exactly when they promoted him this year, promoted him to Tampa, started this year in Trenton. Now he's in AAA, and he just keeps hitting. And the problem, it's not really a problem, but the thing the Yankees have to deal with is that his bat is just far ahead of his defense. You know, he's still learning the second base position and getting familiarizing himself with it, because even though he played it in high school, I mean, that's high school. It's not playing it at even the AA level or whatever, and he just has to learn it more. And you know, you look at what he's doing, it's like, man, this guy would be better than Brian Roberts right now. I don't know if that's really the case, because you know, hitting major league pitching is hard, especially if he's not going to be great at defense. You know, you just give him a couple weeks in AAA before we start thinking about how we could help the team this year.
Yeah, and there's another thought, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that Alfonso Soriano just isn't hitting at all. I mean, period. And Carlos Beltran just really isn't ready for probably a few weeks to play the outfield again. Maybe another week or two, it sounds like. So, you know, is he an option maybe to stick in the outfield, maybe right field, if they feel like Ichiro isn't really going to provide them with the offense that they need?
You know, maybe, but I think it's at a point with them where they're saying, you know, we've worked so hard to get this guy back at second base. Mm. Let's not just throw it all, you know, kind of put that on hold and stick him back in the outfield and do something like that. I think, you know, in a perfect kind of world situation, the prospect's development timetable shouldn't change because of something at the big league level, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, you'd like to say that, but it really hasn't been that true for the Yankees in the years where they didn't really have a pitching prospect. I mean, maybe in the maybe somewhere you could say in the position player, yeah, I can agree. They don't rush anybody. They stick with their development plan. The last time I remember them moving a guy up out of his development plan because they literally had no one to play a position had to be Melky Cabrera. I mean, Melky was not ready for prime time when they brought him up.
Oh, in July 05? That was a disaster. Yeah.
Well, I was at one of those games. I remember it so well. I believe I was at the Melky game where he let Trot Nixon get the in the park home run. It was really, really disappointing to see. And I guess the same kind of could be said for a guy like Rye Snyder or even like a Pete O'Brien. Guys that, you know, it's really fun to watch them doing what they're doing at this minor league level and just tearing the cover off the ball. But when they get up to this point, Mike makes a really good point about defense just still being a huge part. And Melky was, I think, a very good example of that kind of situation.
Yeah, and the Yankees have enough infield defense problems as it is. And you know, Roberts is not hasn't hit, but he hasn't been like horrible. I think he's got like a 310 on base percentage or something like that. And if Ref Snyder's not going to really beat that, then it's you're not really making just a lateral move, and you risk kind of throwing off his development there. And I think for them to kind of call him up this year, I think Roberts would, you know, Roberts probably might get hurt, which he has a tendency to do, or he just completely just stops hitting altogether and kind of forces their hand.
Yeah, I think for me, and you can kind of loop Jose Perella into that kind of group as well, mm-hmm. of like, you know, I feel like Brian Roberts has to hit a level of such uselessness for them to actually cut bait on him. And I feel like they've looked at it as, well, it works, and it's worked to this point, so why screw with it?
Yeah, and you know, and the thing is that I get the sense that if they were to make a call up Perella or Ref Snyder or whoever, it wouldn't necessarily be Roberts who goes. I feel like it would be Kelly Johnson first, because the Yankees just apparently just have like no use for Johnson. They don't know what to do with him, and they like Roberts for whatever reason. They seem to they're sticking with him, and I think it seems like Kelly Johnson would be the first one to go. And I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's just I feel like that's where it's heading.
Yep, yeah, I totally agree.
I think that they're going to stick with the cheap hand as long as possible before they start making situations occur where they need to like worry about who gets paid what in years to come. And, you know, you look at guys like Kelly Johnson and Brian Roberts, and why not just stick with the hand you know until eventually you can go a different position or a different direction. And I just don't see them making that change at this point, at least not in June. I mean, yeah, I can see it's in August or maybe a September thing.
I remember when they called up Cano, it was because Tony Womack was just awful. And Tony Womack was far worse than Brian Roberts is. I mean, yeah. they had no choice but to get rid of not really get rid of him. They kept him, but replace Womack at second base. And Ref Snyder is not Robinson Cano, certainly not now, and he's not even Robinson Cano who Cano was back then. And
mm-hmm.
You know, that was kind of an emergency thing where they had to call him up, and you know, because they were losing too many games and they weren't getting any production there. And Roberts has been like just good enough to keep his job, and you know, so there's no and you know, it's good. I think the Ref Snyder should spend at least a few weeks in AAA. I mean, you know, you don't want to. I feel like they're just kind of skipping this guy. You know, he's going to end up playing in three levels in the span of 12 months, and that's might be a little bit too much to just do so much so quickly.
Yeah. So with that, I think what we'll do is we've got an interview coming up next. Joe, you're talking to someone today. Who's that?
Yeah, Jason Wojciechowski. He's a writer. He writes beanball.org. It's an A's blog. All right, we're back with Jason Wojciechowski. I pronounced that correctly, right?
It's yes.
All right. I mean, hey, as a fellow Polak with a very difficult to pronounce last name, you like to get these things right. So you write a site called beanball.org, and I'm sure baseball fans can tell how that's spelled. And you know, it's all about the A's. You also host a podcast with Matthew Corey of Over the Monster, correct?
Yes, a sort of general non-team affiliated podcast, Back of the Bullpen.
Ah, excellent. So
available all the usual places.
Yes. Well, we are talking more about the A's right now, which is your forte. And so I think, you know, the Yankees, baseball has scheduled kind of strange this year, where it seems like they're given teams, at least with the Yankees, like they played the Angels and then they played them again like two series later. And now they're doing the same thing with the A's, where they played them last week and now they're playing them again this week. So two teams have seen each other, but I think there's still some more stuff to uncover here, Jason, because what do the A's do to get results, and not just results, like all-star results out of guys like Brandon Moss and Josh Donaldson? Like, what is there voodoo? They have a hitting coach who just knows what he's doing. These are two guys who didn't do much before they got there, and now they're stars.
Yeah, I think it's either voodoo or luck. you know, I don't know. You know, every team, whenever they find someone like this, and almost every team finds someone like this at some point, you know, in the course of their, you know, a general manager's career or whatever, they've always got some reasons. Like, oh, this, you know, this AGM really said that he was going to be, he saw, you know, the hidden talent or whatever. And, you know, I don't know, you see hidden talent a lot of times, and you never hear about the hidden talent that they saw in Kila Kaahue.
man, you know, what a name drop.
Well, he was with the – I mean, this is the thing. The A's exec did this exact thing with him, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, he's totally like a Billy Bean pickup. They must have seen something, you know, underappreciated, kind of maybe seen as a quad A slugger type, and that's exactly what he turned out to be. And you know, the A's sort of dropped him almost as fast as they picked him up. Brandon Jacobs is another one. No, not Brandon Jacobs. I don't know, Brandon Allen, I think.
Brandon Allen, he came over, he was with the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, and he did hit like a 450-foot homer in Yankee Stadium, I think.
I remember it well. Oh, I remember it very well. Hit one of the first guys hit the upper deck in the new stadium.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so, you know, but that's, you know, it looks like it's his only career highlight. So so I think if you fail to sort of develop a real first baseman post Jason Giambi, and you keep bringing in Moss and Kaahue and Allen, it's almost like you're eventually going to hit on one. Now, there might also be, you know, Brandon Moss kind of has that approach that seems to be working for a handful of guys, where it's just like, what's your approach to the plate? Well, I'm going to get a pitch to hit and I'm going to swing real hard. I think as Sam Miller likes to say, maybe baseball's not as hard as we all think it is. Maybe pitchers don't actually need four pitches, and maybe hitters don't need, you know, to really think about going the other way and, you know, all these other things. Maybe they should just get up there and swing real hard, because it's worked for Donaldson. It's worked for Moss.
Worked for Carlos Gomez.
It's worked for – that's the sort of national star-level player that I should have thought of and who I was struggling for. Yeah, no, that's exactly who it's worked for. You know, quit trying to be the little slappy whatever and just swing real hard, and good things can happen. And if good things don't happen, well, it's not like good things were happening before.
Yeah, and the Yankees have another guy going on with that right now, Yenjirvis Solarte. And the guy, he does not get cheated on his swings. You know, he's a career minor leaguer, barely OPS 700 in the most of the levels of the minors. You know, 26 years old this year, first time cracking not just a major league roster, a 40-man roster. And, you know, you see it every time up there. He is just wailing on any pitch that comes near him.
Maybe we've been doing it wrong for 100 years of baseball.
Yeah, perhaps. And, you know, the A's have turned that into such success this year. I always like, and I cited this, I think, in the last A's preview podcast. If you go to baseballreference.com and look at their simple ratings system, I'm not sure what to make of this. They have a formula that they, you know, weigh strength of schedule and other elements. It basically says the A's are by far the best team in baseball and everyone else is pretty terrible. Like, they are 2.1 in this simple rating system. The next closest team is the Angels behind them at 0.8. Like, that's how far and away Oakland is considered better than other teams by this system. And, you know, they're the second most wins in the league, most in the American League. And is there anything they don't do well? I mean, they picked up Kyle Blanks for basically nothing, and now they've made him a right-handed compliment to Brandon Moss at first base, and he's thriving.
Yeah, that was actually an interesting pickup, because they had Nate Freiman in that role all of last year, and they decided to send him down and use Derek Barton as the right, you know, he's not right-handed, as the compliment. And that didn't work out, but instead of just bringing up Freiman, they decided to go get Blanks. And Blanks is maybe another one of these guys, kind of a change of scenery candidate, had really struggled with injuries, a lot of hitting talent, more athletic than he looks. He was a big, giant guy. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to turn into the next superstar, but he, you know, given the way that the A's, Bob Melvin has taken the roster that Billy Bean gives him, and, you know, sort of, what is the managerial trope, putting guys in a place to succeed.
Yep.
That's what they can do with Blanks, and he can play the outfield a little. Maybe that's a reason to have him instead of Freiman, who's kind of a born DH. But, you know, what they don't the shortstop defense is not super great. Jim Johnson's terrible. You know that there are a few things maybe that they don't really, they can't hit at second base. They don't have a second baseman.
Eric Sogard is like I think he's the worst. Is he qualified? If he's qualified, he's got to be the worst hitter in the league.
He might be qualified because he basically plays against all righties, and so that might have gotten him so far enough plate appearances. It seems like there might be a good chance he may not wind up qualifying if he keeps hitting like this. But it's essentially one position where they can't hit. Or two positions when Josh Reddick gets back, because I have more or less given up on him as a hitter. Mm. But at least he's a good defender. Sogard is, you know, fine, basically. He's a nice stopgap for – I'm hoping that Jed Lowry plays second base next year.
I thought he was a free agent after this year.
He is a free agent, which would be a good assumption that he'll leave. But yeah, I want Lou Wolf to suddenly just open the pocketbooks and decide, you know, Jed Lowry, that's who we're going to spend on as a second baseman, because we've got our shortstop of the future, Addison Russell.
Yeah, right, so right.
That's my dream, is that Jed Lowry solidifies second base for the next 4 years.
Yeah, it does seem, and it seems they do have a window right now. You know, the oldest starter they have running out is Coco Crisp, and he's having a career year so far this year. And that's hard because he's had a bunch of them lately.
Yeah, it seems like every year is a career year, the last three or four.
You know, I'm going to get a little off track here, because I remember, and it happened again this year, I remember when Johnny Damon left the Red Sox and they traded for Coco Crisp. And, you know, they were all excited, like, oh, Coco Crisp, we're going to get Damon's production for half, you know, a quarter of what he's making. And he kind of flopped. And he went out to Kansas City and he was okay. And he goes out to Oakland and all of a sudden he's an all-star.
Yeah, I don't – he might have started swinging hard too, because he'll every once in a while just sort of yank one, particularly – well, I don't want to say particularly because I'm going to get it wrong if I take a guess about which side he hits better from. But it seems like maybe from the left side he'll just – you know, poke one, like, you know, if the wall is 315, he'll poke it 316. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, just get it out. He's Jonah Carey did that great sort of sit down with him about how he steals bases, because he's fast, but there's a lot of fast guys in the league and not everybody steals at like a 95% rate or whatever it is that he does. I think it's just some sort of combination of, for whatever reason, the physical decline hasn't really set in, but he's getting the benefit of being older and experienced. And, you know, it's usually the trade-off, right? Yeah. You get older and you're smarter, but your body just can't do it anymore.
Youth is wasted on the young, as they say.
Right. Coco, the youth, I don't know. His age is not catching up with them just yet, I guess. And now that I said that, he's going to spend the rest of the year on the disabled list. But he has actually lately had a neck problem where he's basically been playing every other day, which is just sort of what you deal with Coco Crisp. You don't think you're going to get 162 games. I don't know what his career high is, but I don't think it's over like 140 or 145.
Yeah, he's under contract through 2016, right?
Yeah, that was a weird thing. They traded Michael Choice for Craig Gentry from the Rangers, in-division trade, the mythical in-division trade. And it was like, well, there's our center fielder of the future. He'll be the fourth outfielder this year. Coco leaves in free agency because he's like 35. They're never going to re-sign him. And then I don't even know how quickly, very quickly after that, they signed Coco to an extension. And it's like, well, I guess Craig Gentry is our fourth outfielder of the future. We don't really know what the hell he is now. That's Coco will be around for a while, it appears, oddly.
Yeah, it makes enough sense if they think he's going to keep producing at a decent level. As you said, he can't play every day, so Gentry has plenty of opportunities to play. And
right.
And he's not a terrible hitter. He's not a good hitter. He's got no power. He's never had power. But, you know, from everything I've heard, he's pretty slick out in the field.
Yeah, I like watching him play defense. I like watching the entire – obviously, Cespedes has the cannon arm and the, you know, lapses in concentration to make it fun. Yeah. And then Reddick is kind of a legend in his own right. Crisp, It's like if you could combine these guys, if you can combine Cespedes and Crisp, you'd have, I don't know, it's like Willie Mays, basically, because, you know, Crisp has the sort of chicken wing arm throws, and but he'll just runs balls down. I don't know what the numbers say, but I am always perfectly comfortable with him in the outfield. You know, I see a ball in the gap, and my first thought is that he's going to get it, rather than, you know, other, you know, maybe Dodgers fans might say, well, that's going to fall.
Yeah, no, and I totally agree. And I like that, you know, I said defensive stats. I've been very vocal about my problems with the current crop of defensive stats. There's a lot of bias involved, but I always like the test. And, you know, people say the eyeball test, but I do think you brought up a very reliable eyeball test. It's when he's chasing the ball down in the gap, you know he has it. And I felt like, you know, Curtis Granderson, defensive metrics weren't very kind to him. And maybe he didn't have the best range in center field, but when he ran down a ball in the gap, I could tell within the first three steps if he was going to catch it or not. I don't know if that's like a huge positive in his, or he's just a good, predictable guy. But I think it has to have some measure of value in the outfield.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of a mental heuristic. I mean, we watch these players every day, and there's difficulties. It's on TV. It's, you know, whatever. But you do start to get a sense of their abilities. It's always sort of laughable, the Gold Glove voting, where, you know, players who see each other or coaches or whatever who see them five times in a year and they vote based on that. I think like those fan scouting reports are a little weird too, but I'd rather have the fan scouting report, I think, than the player scouting report, just on sheer numbers, even though the players have a much better view and know a lot more than we do.
Yeah, no, I think you can get enough fans, together, especially if you get a good group that is actually at the games. You have to get a good sampling of guys who are at the games versus ones who watch on TV. But I definitely think that there's you can get value out of a group that is watching the same thing over and over and over again.
Right.
All right, so we've been talking about offense and we hit on defense, so the next natural stop is pitching, and I feel like the Yankees are running into the buzzsaw this weekend because they get Sonny Gray, Scott Kazmir, and Jesse Chavez. And I guess Drew Pomeranz by ERA has better numbers than Chavez, but it feels like Chavez is just a bit more solid. Is that kind of, would you agree with that, or is there more to Pomeranz than the numbers?
I don't have any faith in Pomeranz because of the component numbers. You know, he kind of earned his way into the rotation when Dan Straley earned his way out by just never really giving up any runs, but he also never struck anybody out, you know, and I think it's going to come crashing down. On the other hand, you know, every game that he goes out there and it doesn't come crashing down, you start to wonder whether he's, you know, a kind of a low BABIP guy, you know, a soft contact guy. These guys are, you know, they're rare, and I don't trust our ability to find them, but they appear to exist.
Yeah.
And so maybe he is going to be one of them. Chavez, I also don't know how much I trust, but that's just based on, you know, years of being mediocre. And the whole thing is that he added the cutter. The cutter is now his thing, and that's what made him great. And we've heard this story 1,000 times. On the other hand, how many times have we sort of like the pet projects assistant GM game? How many times have we heard the guy add the pitch and then we never hear it again, and nobody wants to talk about it because adding the pitch didn't work that time. So I don't know if he's for real or not. Kazmir and Gray, I have full faith in Gray, despite how young he is. Kazmir, I've been surprised by. I didn't realize really how good his stuff was. He was sort of, I guess, literally out of the league, and certainly out of public attention for so long, and the injuries and everything else. And I kind of thought he came back. I just sort of assumed, I guess, that he came back a completely different pitcher, a soft tosser, or whatever. He throws hard. He's got a ridiculous changeup. It looks legit. Like the watching the pitches and watching the swings that batters take and watching him work, it absolutely matches what he's done this year and last year.
Yeah, no, it's hard to argue with Gray. I remember watching him last year because I hadn't heard the name. It was a first-round draft pick, but I'm not a big draft guy.
Yeah, and he's a low pick. You know, it's just a college, you know, college pitcher. Mm-hmm. Under, you know, and there was a lot of debate about whether he was a starter or reliever. He wasn't. He was certainly not a guy to really pay attention to.
Yeah, and then he came up, and you know, just last year, it's fair to say he dominated, and this year he seems like he's almost not missed a beat. He's not striking out as many guys, but we're still early in the season. He pitched less last season than he has this season, so there's still a few things left to figure out about him. But there's not much not to like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anybody that size, you always get the sort of injury concern. Can he hold up and all of that stuff? But you know, the A's have history. The A's have the Tim Hudson history. He doesn't actually remind me all that much of Tim Hudson. It's really anybody who makes that comp, I think, is almost relying entirely on size and maybe that they're both from the South or something. But other than that, it's really, you know, he's his own pitcher. I don't even really have a good comp. But yeah, you know, stuff wise, it's there. I don't like to get into these kinds of things too much, but he seems, you know, he's relatively even keeled. He doesn't get jacked up. He doesn't seem to get ruffled by, you know, an error behind him, that kind of thing. And you know, you can overstate those sorts of things. Ben Grieve always there's a name, but Ben Grieve always got harassed by fans for not showing enough emotion. He'd hit into a double play and he wouldn't break his bat over his knee or whatever, and everybody hated him. So you know, visible displays of emotion, not necessarily the judge of a player and his psychology, but you know, for what it's worth, he certainly seems like he's got a handle on things, particularly for a 24-year-old or whatever in his first full season.
Yeah, I'm absolutely not at all looking forward to seeing him on Friday night. That's not going to be fun. It might make the other games a bit more palatable, although, again, Kazmir pitched pretty well last time out against the Yankees. So before we end this little chat, there's one player who really stands out to me in the A's bullpen, mainly because I picked him up in fantasy earlier in the year betting this would happen, and it did. Sean Doolittle slid into the closer's role. It seems like he has an interesting story. You know, he's a supplemental first-round pick, but it took him 5 years to get to the majors. And he's been good, but I guess not reliable until this year. Would that be a characterization that's kind of accurate?
Well, I mean, he was a first baseman I guess if it took him 5 years, 3.5 or 4.5 of those years. And he actually, if I remember right, he hit fairly well. And he was always known as a guy who could play a little defense too. Obviously had an arm because he's now pitching.
Yeah.
But had injury problems. And weirdly, I guess the A's decided the way to solve his injury problem was to put him on the mound.
Yeah, that's kind of odd.
But I think it was, you know, I think it was knees. I think he had some knee stuff. I don't remember what it was. I don't think it was arm issues. And it's just sort of worked out. He throws in the kind of low mid-90s, like, I don't know if he cracks 95 very often, but pretty consistently 93, 94. And it's all he throws. He's like Bartolo Colon in relief. He just throws a fastball, and nobody can see it, and nobody can hit it. And they just, I don't know what to say. This is another example of, like, maybe baseball is not actually that hard. If you can, you know, he's got this weird, like, the way his glove, his lead hand kind of flings out. And I think, you know, Saris did an interview with him looked at video or something. But basically, it's really deceptive. Like, you just can't pick up that fastball, particularly since he throws it high in the zone. And you'll see guys swinging at fastballs at the eyes. Players that don't necessarily do that. This isn't the wild, out-of-control swingers necessarily. It's just something about the ball just comes up on them so fast that they have to make that snap decision, and they can't catch up with it by the time they do. So you know, you get worried, I guess, about a one-pitch pitcher and whether if that one pitch goes away or if the league finally figures out some way to approach it, you know, whether he's going to adjust. But, I mean, I think you know about dominant one-pitch pitchers. Yeah. And
you talk to a bunch of people who do, so.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just something about that pitch or that approach or whatever it is, it can work in relief. So hopefully, maybe he's that guy.
Yeah, and I mean, he's got probably the most, one of the most insane stats this year. 44 strikeouts to one walk. That is like Dennis Eckersley territory.
It is. He actually, I was tracking it a little bit earlier in the year. Going back to last year, he was getting within shouting distance of the record for most appearances in a row. Most straight appearances without a walk. And that record, I believe, is held by Eckersley. And I think he wound up, you know, 10 or so or 12 games short. But he wound up in Koji Uehara territory, which I think says something. Uehara being probably our sort of current Eckersley, especially given that Eckersley didn't throw 95 like Doolittle does.
Yeah, no, and Uehara was the guy everyone was talking about last year, you know, being that crazy guy who never walked anybody. And it seems like that's totally Doolittle's thing this year. I guess, unfortunately, his walk came in the middle of May, so he's got to restart that streak.
Yeah, he didn't go, you know, 55 games and then walk somebody. He's got to, you know, he got up into the 40s and he's going to have to do that all over again. It's or maybe the high, I don't remember exactly where he got, but it, you know, from a streak perspective, it wasn't ideal. I think somebody should talk to him about that.
No, I guess not. Well, Jason, it was great talking to you. And I feel like in these interviews, like I really think you gave our listeners a sense of what to expect this series with the A's, which is three straight losses.
Well, you know, certainly I hope so. not for your sake and not for the sake of the listeners, many of whom I'm sure I would very much love to share a beer with. But yeah, for my own happiness, I can agree with that.
All right, everybody. Once again, that was Jason Wojciechowski from Beanball and the Back of the Bullpen podcast. And with that, another edition of the River Avenue Blues podcast comes to a close. Thanks again to Jason Wojciechowski for giving us a really great A's conversation. As so for Mike and Jay, I'm Joe, and we'll talk to you next week.